built differently anyway. The logic is sort of analog logic instead of sort of, you know, up, down, in, out, black, white kind of thing that English has, where, you know, we're always chopping things into opposites. And Finnish, like Eskimo, or it doesn't operate quite the same way.
Oh.
Everything sort of related to everything else in a very complex way, and not necessarily, it doesn't. But, you know, if you say someone went out of the room and said, hen meni ulos, you know, hen, you use hen for male or female. You can say, you know, boy or girl or man or woman, but you don't.
Is it a very egalitarian or non-sexist environment?
Well, actually, you know, historically, or early contact is very definite. You know, what they say. Division du travail social, social division of labor, but actually it sort of put the women on top. Because in the old pattern, the farm was the woman's property. She was responsible for the field and the cattle. The man went off to with the horses to work the woods or went off trapping or something like that. But the emmende, the boss, was the woman. Things settled. And I remember that was fairly strongly true in the case of my grandmother and my mother. The rivalry was not between my father, but between my grandmother and my mother. You know, one of the things about this whole thing about feminism, male, female, is people forget the generational thing.
Oh, and I think that's very important.
And that's a very important thing. Mm-hmm. But the result, you know, I mean, for example, when the Finns finally got the unicameral legislature in 1905, one quarter of the people elected were women. Mm. One third of the people around were women. And this was 1905. And not only the women had the franchise, even before it had been a class franchise. You know, you could vote for the particular house that you're in. There were no women who had served in any of the four houses. But
Well, do you think that this again was a subtle influence on how you felt about life in the, later politically on
sure.
the feminist issues and things? Mm.
And I think, you know, that had a lot to do with. It's interesting. I think one of Amina Kant was a famous Finnish feminist. There was, you know, that was actually part of the background. I mean, that was part of folk history, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the oldest written document in Finnish is a Karelian. When the Swedes, you know, conquered that area, they. Mm-hmm. They tried to codify the laws, and the one portion that survived was the rights of women.
Hmm.
I mean, and this was 13th century, you know, the right to own property, and, you know, and there was a whole slew of things that they had to codify because they're so different from what was in place in Sweden.
Mm-hmm.
And,
mm-hmm.
you know, these are the local laws for this particular strange population that they were having to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
And the one piece of what it must have been a longer document that survived is this whole list of things that women could do that Swedish women couldn't do. And so I think it, you know, it has a different different kind. And I've always been aware, even, you know, here I am, you know, third generation American, and how somehow I and don't share a lot of the kind of backgrounds or.
Well, I think again, so much of your mores come from your child that you're just not even aware of, and they germinate, and flourish, and you're not conscious of this at all. But I think that's why it makes it so very hard for people to change, because we have to make a really, really conscious decision to change your way of thinking that is so instinctive, because it was there before you even knew you were thinking.
Well, I think at least, you know, I'm not saying all film, but the particular kind of background I was, it was always expected that anything, you know, family or any venture, construction venture or something, was always a joint activity, a sharing kind of thing, with nobody on top and everybody doing his mm-hmm. part of the thing and mm-hmm. figuring that mm-hmm. out together.
Mm-hmm.
And I continually run into trouble when I forget that most people coming from an Anglo-Saxon background think of it in a hierarchical sense.
Absolutely.
Somebody is boss telling
Absolutely.
Somebody else, and I just don't buy that. I mean, it's very hard.
Mm-hmm. Well, these work much better if it isn't in that situation, but in the re-education.
Mm-hmm.
Now we must be somewhere. You were through with out of the school system and things were sort of a difficult time. What did you do? Just sort of.
Well, when there was a right-wing school board elected, mm-hmm. Mary Kay Barstate, Cam Carlson, and Nancy Mendenhall, mm-hmm. and Chuck Reese, and they selected Chuck Smith to be superintendent of schools, who I had absolutely no respect for. Who mm-hmm. Chuck was in Fairbanks that summer, and he worked at the Talk of the Town Club for Alex Miller in South Fairbanks, which was a I'd gone down there with some of the other miners and seen them. But the thing was, later when Smith came back here and he had, you know, found Christ and everything like that, was a real strict kind of Martin, and actually a very unsuccessful schoolman. But he had political connections. He was very active in athletic mm-hmm. teams and things like that, and his political connections were very good. Well, he took a very sort of right-wing, moralistic mm-hmm. approach, but I think one of the things that bugged him was that he knew that I knew that he had worked in a, shall we say, a questionable establishment earlier in Fairbanks. But he was a hypocrite.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was terrible. I mean, well, anyway, he's one of the few people I really continue to dislike and find it hard to accept as a person.
So he kicked you out of the school system?
No, he tried to, but I had tenure. But I, mm-hmm. but nevertheless, yeah, he essentially did, because I wouldn't work for him.
Mm-hmm.
I resigned. Mm-hmm. I said I couldn't. I wrote my letter of resignation. I couldn't work for someone whom I couldn't respect.
Good for you.
Yeah. So, I mean, his coming may import mm-hmm. my departure. I could have stayed. I think it would have been unhappier. I went to work for Head Start.
Mm-hmm. I remember because that's when I first met you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I was Head Start director. I helped set up the thing. I'd been mm-hmm. the godfather for Head Start mm-hmm. for so many years. And I helped it survive the Nixon years, because Nixon was trying to kill it mm-hmm. every time.
Mm-hmm.
My defense was the Xerox machine. They wrote one directive, I replied with three
mm-hmm.
responses.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I had learned bureaucraties better than even Regent Ten had.
So it
was a fight, but I mean, uh-huh. I uh-huh. could, and that was one of the things that, it was hard, but it gave me something very productive and constructive to do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So then, when did you think of entering politics? I mean, skipping something?
Well, I'd always been interested in mm-hmm. politics, and in territorial times, a number of us got interested in the idea of having a knowledge, helping write the Constitution for the state before statehood itself.
Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Ryan, who was superintendent of schools, mm-hmm. helped organize the All Alaska League for a State Constitution. All Alaska ended up being only Fairbanks. The Anchorage group was a different group. But we had meetings, and I served on the committee for the Bill of Rights. And we had subcommittees, and in fact, the legislation that was put in by Bob McNeely, setting up the Constitutional Convention with that elaborate system of election where some people were elected from very small localities and others mm-hmm. from slightly broader constituencies and others mm-hmm. from election district, which the judicial districts, which was the only way of election in those days, and still others from statewide, mm-hmm. giving us 55 delegates. That I had suggested that, because 55 was the sacred number that had been at Annapolis, mm-hmm. For the mm-hmm. Constitutional Convention,
mm-hmm.
and I also tried to figure out a way that we could get as broad a representation. So that mm-hmm. was my suggestion mm-hmm. to McNeely, who put it into the act, which was the Constitutional mm. Convention. And then a number of us who had been active in that effort and in some of the labor groups and some of the native groups organized, we were separately from the Democrat. We had first a group called the Nonpartisan League, which was a good government group. You know, we interviewed candidates mm-hmm. And made endorsements. And then we organized what was known as the Alaska Party, which was a sort of farmer labor party, a progressive party. It took much of its ideology from the sort of farmer labor parties of the Midwest of the United States. I was active in that in territorial days.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I was nominated to be their candidate for territorial auditor, which was because we wanted to have a statewide mm-hmm. position. And an Indian, Markle Ewan, ran from the Copper Valley. He was an Anapnan, one of the three people whom I credit with starting the land claims movement. Came within 18 votes of being elected to the territorial legislature, mm-hmm. I think in 56 or 58, I can't remember the exact year, 56, I think. And Kay Hitchcock, who was the wife of Ben Hitchcock, one of the other, quote, founders, came much closer. A lot of the people who were inactive in that, Larry Brayton, for example, had a lot to do with the rural Alaska Community Action, Fairbanks Community Action in the Kennedy mm-hmm. years later. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them were active in the Surveyors Union or mm-hmm. in the Farmers Co-op. And as I say, in the beginning of the land claim movement.
So you've been active politically for a long time, and then right. after, I guess you sort of went back to farming and just looking at things from a distance? Or did
yeah,
you
well,
step
when
out
statehood came, the Alaska Party was dropped from the ballot because of the change in the mm-hmm. election procedures.
Yeah.
You had to have run somebody for governor, which mm-hmm. was, and we hadn't run anybody for governor, so we weren't on the ballot. And I was teaching, and I dropped out of political action, except that went to the meeting of the organizing meeting of the Alaska Education Association in Seward. I think it was 59. School year 59-60. Been a member here mm-hmm. when I was started teaching in 58. Then met Nick Begich, and a brand new teacher out of Fort Yukon, Don Young, and big fight was over the issue of whether we should have the non-communist oath or not, and which we had in those days. And we narrowly lost, but those who were very active against that one got active in other political ways and mm-hmm. formed Political Action Committee for Education.
Mm-hmm.
And I was active in PACE for many years, which meant that I couldn't be partisan. I had to find the best candidates, Republican or Democrat,
mm-hmm.
one of whom for a long time was Don Young. So I had a lot to, fair amount to do with Don. I thought he was a fine member of the state legislature, but he wasn't. He was out of his depth by the time he got to state senate.
I don't think he basically has the smarts.
He probably would have been there
fine in that category, but
that's exactly what happened.
Peter
got out of it. But
yeah.
Nick Begich was really something else.
Yeah,
he was really a great man. And I worked with Greening and Bartlett mm-hmm. and Rivers. Mm-hmm. I'd not gotten to know all these people at the Constitutional Convention because I'd worked,
mm-hmm.
for the thing, and then when the convention was held, I'd run, but I'd lost.
Mm-hmm.
But I was working for the university, and I was assigned to be the electrician in charge of mm-hmm. the electrical apparatus, so I knew people there and talked with all of them. So I remained, in contact politically and active on a nonpartisan level for a number mm-hmm. of years. And then I got to backing Nick Begich for federal office, and at that point I began to resume partisan activity, and this time it was in the Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm.
In 1960, then part of it must I had must admit, when I went out to Harvard, of course, working with the Kennedy people so closely, especially, and then the Vietnam War anthem protest, I was active in that. Worked for Johnson's election against Goldwater, of course. Came back to vote for that here. Then, but I guess it was 68 when Nick ran statewide. And Fred Brown, myself, and our friend at the fair.
Oh, Janet.
Janet were the three people who supported Nick Begich in the first, in Fairbanks, we set up the first Nick Begich organization at that time. And I became the precinct chair, I think it was 68 or 70 in Chena. So we organized that area for Nick.
What would you say, I mean, even at this point, would you look at your life and say were real highlights or things you felt really... What would you say were real highlights or things you felt very proud of accomplishing? In a sense, I think that...
No, Head Start.
Head Start.
The whole child care, you know, the daycare assistance program, stuff like that. I had, thanks to Joan's uncle, Dr. Henry Forbes, a large part in the beginning of the Native Land Claims Movement. It didn't come out the way we wanted it to, but at least, you know, this question was settled.
How did Joan's uncle have something to do with it?
Well, it was very funny. The Alaska Party had a meeting in December of 57 in Palmer, and there were three delegates showed up from the Copper Valley. There was Mark Aliwan, whom I mentioned, Oscar Craig, and Walter Charlie, who's still alive, and one of the senior chiefs, and they wanted our support helping the Oknaw get Lake Louise back, which they had given the military right to use during the war. And that piqued our interest. The party passed a resolution in favor of that, and then most of us, including Charlie Purvis and Al Ketzler, who was a member of the Alaska Party, and got active in that. We contacted first the Friends Indian Rights Association, Ted Hetzel, in Haverford, PA, and he came up here, and he talked to people, looked at the situation, suggested we call in the Association on American Indian Affairs, Oliver LaFarge and his group, and Laverne Madigan was the executive director at that time. Well, it turned out that Uncle Harry, Dr. Henry Forbes, was a member of the executive committee of that. And he was Joan's father's brother and had been the family doctor and everything like that. He came up and stayed with us and met Howard Rock, and because... he was fairly comfortably set and been a doctor for many years, and ended up subsidizing the formation of the Tundra Times and subsidized it for many years thereafter. Aunt Hildegard and Uncle Harry and all that. So we went during the war, during the time at Harvard. Because I was there, you know, fairly close at hand, I could go down to Washington for the hearings or from New York to the AAI meetings. And now, of course, the things didn't come to a head until later, but one of the things they did was to organize the second Tanana Chiefs Conference at Nuchilawaya at Tanana, and the Inupiat Piatot, which became the North Slope Association, and working with people and beginning to organize, which is actually one of the reasons the Atna group remained itself, because they were one of the early ones and conscious of it and striving to keep from being absorbed by some of the political wheeler dealers and other Native associations that later got formed. But all of that, of course, is very unpopular, even in Native groups, to be reminded that anybody else did anything about it. But then they...
That's all right. Well, look, this, I just realizing, I do get it. Well,
I think it's always true because, you know, during the 60s, people, you know, the student groups who were against the war and everything, they didn't build on previous history. Everybody wants to discover things for themselves, and they don't want to feel that they're recapitulating what people have done before. But then, of course, what is it? Who? The philosopher at Harvard said that those who do not remember history are condemned to repeat it.
We have to learn from
the past, and sometimes people get too wrapped up in what's gone before and don't ever get out of it. They say you just get so locked into remembering the past or reliving it, or maybe that leads to the same kind of error. Remember that they used to say of the Bourbons, the dynasty that ruled Spain and Austria, and they never forgot anything, but they never learned anything either. So I don't know, but you know. And I think that, you know, that's certainly true in the civil rights movement. Everybody sort of dates it from Rosa Parks or something like that. And every time you look for somebody, you find people who are involved with people who were involved before. And my God, that's all the way back to Lincoln or something like that.
Well, yeah, I think it's again, you know, realizing the commonality between people all the time, right. The attachment to this.
And we, you know, when we were starting looking into the native land claims problem in the late 50s and early 60s, we found that there were records people had filed for native allotments, 160-acre allotments, and that had been started by Judge Wickersham when he was in Fairbanks. He called the first Tananaw Chiefs Conference together and told the natives that they should protect their land holdings by filing. And what happened, of course, was in the first few years there wasn't very much. There wasn't very much happening, but the land office did begin to allow native allotments, so you do have some of them, but after 1920, after Harding's election, they stopped processing them. They just piled up and they went into a bureaucratic holding pattern and then started denying them, but there were several hundred or maybe more, maybe thousands of over a thousand, several thousand of those, which had been filed from 1915 through the early 30s, well, by the time people got discouraged. But certainly if that had been through, I think a lot of the problems of the Anilka would have been, would not have. And in fact, the original Treaty of Accession stated very clearly that the property rights of the inhabitants had to be taken care of. And every time Congress acted, they reaffirmed that, you know, in 1870 and 1880 and 82 and 80 and 90 and 1900 and 1912. But they never bothered doing anything about it. And I think there had been some attempts, certainly, to that. I know that, for instance, Nervik, when the people settled there, they got asked for and got a reservation claim, and there were some of them, like Tyonek and others, where the people had themselves petitioned to get certain lands granted them, but they were reservations, which you know, it was a very restricted kind of thing. So there'd been a number of attempts. I mean, you can't claim that any one person. And then William Paul, who was the Tlingit politician and leader and organizer of the Alaska Native Brotherhood, started a lawsuit in the 20s for lands in southeastern Alaska that weren't, that lawsuit wasn't settled until the beginning of, well, about the land claims, just before the land claims. And in fact, one of the settlements in that provided that they extinguished all their claims, and they promptly went and filed under an ILCA too and got a decent amount of money. But one of the problems with that lawsuit, having been started in the 20s, they were only asking for about $7 million, you know, and it dragged on and on and on and on. Mm-hmm. So you can't, you know, and William Paul was became aware of our efforts. He had already moved to Seattle and retired. And seems funny, I think, of an Alaskan Indian leader retiring and moving to Seattle, but he did.
When did you decide to run for office, and what prompted that decision?
You mean a state office? Mm-hmm. Because I had run for the Constitutional Convention, and I'd run territorial day. Well, more or less, it was that I'd been active on, you might say, the grassroots level or on the local level in the party, and running the precinct committee and getting things organized and helping out at the fair and all of these kind of things, and working with the people who were elected, you know, Fred Brown and Brian Rogers and Sally Smith and Steve Cooper, and on particular issues such as daycare assistance and school funding and all of those things. But what happened, of course, was that by 1980, there was a group of my friends did a sort of survey. They sent out a letter and, you know, find out how much support, because I said, you know, I'm more interested in working at the grassroots level. And what was happening, of course, was there weren't as many new people. I don't know. I guess I'd been around so long that people said, why didn't you run? I know Steve Cooper asked me to run in 72, and when I didn't, he did, and I'm glad he did, because he was a good, excellent member of the legislature at that time.
Hmm? Did you have a headache?
A little bit of
that.
No. Anyway, the results of that were pledges. This was in 1980 to support the campaign, and so I acceded to popular demand, quote. I knew very well, as you know, demand of some of my friends who were politically active, but it was a very strong, and I felt somewhat, you know, oh my gosh, you really want me to run kind of thing. So I did, and they worked hard, and I worked hard, and we did a good campaign. Nancy Hidden was my campaign manager. Ron Chin and his wife worked very hard, and a lot of the teachers and a lot of the other people, and Chyna and Gary, son-in-law and daughter, and Dick Ferris, and there's a whole long list of people who worked there, Nana Pauly. Steve did the painting for the campaign.
Did you get in the first time?
No, I didn't. It was very funny. Even that was the Reagan landslide year.
Oh.
And on election night, I was declared elected, which I thought, my goodness, you know. Mm-hmm. However, when the absentees came in, I was behind, and then they did a recount. Actually, they did a double recount because it was so close, and I lost by, well, I think, 14 votes or something like that. Anyway, it was 0.25% of the total vote. And in those days, we were running borough-wide.
Mm-hmm.
So essentially, I was defeated by the votes in the Badger Road. Although I did fairly well in North Pole number 2, which was a rural area, and where, you know, a lot of people old homesteaders tended to vote for me.
Mm-hmm.
People from old homestead days. In Plaque, I did fairly well. I didn't do very well in Badger or North Pole number one. And but my highest precincts were Esther and Goldstream.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the year that there was a coup down in Juneau. That is that. Seizure of the Speaker's office. That's one of the cases where the Canadian parliamentary system would work out much better, you know, mm-hmm. instead of seizing the Speaker's chair by violence, all it'd be is another election, you know,
mm-hmm.
Return to the people, as it were, if the Speaker mm-hmm. loses the confidence, which I think would be a much more reasonable way. And well, the next time I ran, and they had redistricted,
mm-hmm.
and so I was now in District 21, which excluded Esther and Goldstream, which were my strong points, but nevertheless included Chena Ridge and the University and Farmers Loop and things like that. So I won. I ran against Ken Fanning, who was a Libertarian, and defeated him handily. The harder campaign was in the primary against Trudy Kane.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, and that was all mixed up with the Sheffield Cooper election, too.
Yeah, I feel a lot happened there that wasn't. Yeah, it shouldn't have been interfering, but
The second time I had no primary opposition. And there's a long session, so I didn't get back and get started campaigning. And my opponent, Gary Kopas, who was a professor, assistant professor, I guess, at the university in corrections, you know, i.e. how to run a jail, got started early and was supported by his party very strongly, with a lot of, and by...
That was very gratifying that he did not get in assistance.
Right.
With some of the things he did and said. Because when you start supporting a candidate that does it, because a lot of things besides what's going on.
Right.
Anyway. So, are you pleased with what you've done? I mean, I guess that's sort of a hard question to answer because it's very difficult to get anything done in the rest of the country.
No, I think I've managed to accomplish some things. I mean, and I responded to needs.
Mm-hmm.
There was one of the bills I got passed, House Bill 170, had to do with recording surveys, which nobody ever thought was very important or very sexy, but it's something that I was interested in when I was a surveyor, you know, at mm-hmm. statehood time. We were the last state to have to develop a system for recording surveys. So property and private property claims around the state have been getting into a terrible state, you know. You know, somebody has a piece of paper saying he owns a such and such an acreage someplace, and essentially that's just floating until that,
mm-hmm.
until the monuments and corners. And so I worked very hard on that, and the surveyors worked very hard on that. And then that got through, and then there was the midwives, the lay midwives thing, which is a response to a sort of unnecessary emergency. I don't think that they needed to be ruled illegal, but mm-hmm. because there was a possibility because of a claim against a naturopath who extended his sphere of practice, it put them in danger, so
mm-hmm.
we worked on that. And then there was a piece of legislation having to do with cleaning up the student loan program, making it more feasible for, well, a better definition of residency,
mm-hmm.
which,
mm-hmm.
because they had been having to operate arbitrarily on defining residency.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one of them. And even in the first time I served, when I was very definitely in the minority, and the majority wasn't going to allow any minority bills, several of the things that I put in were, you know, sort of folded into other pieces of legislation, either in the Senate side or the House side. One was a simple thing requiring that when a hospital suspends a physician, that they notify the medical board. They'd never done that, so there'd been all kinds of trouble about people who had been suspended for, you know, essentially incompetence, mm-hmm. continuing to practice, and then all sorts of lawsuits starting. Everybody saying, you know, it's your fault. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I think, even though I'm interested in broad social and economic questions, I've been, I suppose, more effective at finding the holes in existing structure and plugging those, filling in the gaps, as it were. But I think, you know, we do have structural problems in the way that we run our legislature. I think that we have to have a system of joint committees so that we don't have this sort of artificial rivalry between the House and the Senate. And I think we have to develop a more open local government kind of pattern. I put in a bill for town meeting governments for small towns.
But,
oh yeah, sure. New England, it's the pattern, and there are others too. And I think that would be useful in Alaska, where everybody does like to speak their mind. They can spend a week in the spring yelling at each other and deciding what the budget's going to be, and then.
Who were the people that you, individuals that you, if you could name them, or who you thought had a great the greatest influence over you in your life? Are they certain influence?
Oh, in the course of my life?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my goodness gracious. A lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody. I learned from everybody, I think. I know Arthur and Elizabeth Morgan, the people at Yellow Springs that I mentioned, who later started the school in North Carolina to which Alex went. They were Quakers. Crippled woman, hunchback woman, who was my boss at Eastern Co-op Wholesale, Beulah Leininger, who was, introduced me to Quakerism, and very, very cheerful, despite being very, you know, physically. A number of the friends, people in among Quakers, both of those people are Quakers. Mark Brinton, the Quaker philosopher, in Pendle Hill. I shouldn't just stick to that. There are people in the labor movement that I knew when I was a kid. People in the co-op house. My mother, my grandfather, my father, too. Certainly he introduced me to a great many things. Teachers in high school, teachers in elementary school. I went to elementary school in New York during the Depression, and yet I enjoyed learning. Classes were overcrowded, but I can remember, you know, kindergarten molding pears and fruits, and then we had a store and ran all that. And there was a school garden. You know, we had so it was a sort of year-round school. And I guess that was more true during the Depression and then subsequently when money became so much more important. It's funny, when we got more money, things that programs were useful disappeared. August Gold, a teacher in high school whose daughter happened be Dr. Carol Gold here at the university, was my social studies teacher and had a great effect on me. He was the one that pointed out to me that there was such a legal position as conscientious objection when I was, you know, searching at that time about what I had to do. Leonard Mannheim, who was an English teacher I referred to, who went on to be the head of the English department at Amherst.
I think he was the first been a lot of people, and it leads me to think of perhaps we all have, or can be, if we are open, influenced by many, many people around us. Maybe the majority of us are very selective, whereas you weren't, and you were open to a great many things all the time. Mm-hmm. Did you have any idea when you were younger of what was going to happen in your life? Did you?
Oh, I don't think so. Okay. Although I was, of course, as I told you before, very interested in coming to Alaska. That was, but that was, you know, one of many thousands of possibilities when you're younger that you turn around in your head. I think not just people, but experiences, you know, doing participating in certain kinds of activities that are important. You know, as I said, having grown up in a co-op house, work camp was very important. Going off at the age of 14 to work in agriculture in the summer by myself was very important. Going to work when I got out of high school was important to turn me one way or the other. Very interesting, actually, that I was not oriented toward an academic career. In fact, I sort of swore that I would, once I got out of high school, I'd never go back to school again. I had enjoyed it, but I also sort of objected to its overstructure and to some of the things that problems organizationally. I know Christopher Columbus discovered America three times by the time I got there. I was always interested in more details than I ever had, rather than the broad outline. I was interested in the broad outline, too. But, and because I read so much, I knew more history, for example, than was ever in the book or in the test. I felt sort of constrained and within the now boundary. I wanted, originally I was interested in something like community and regional planning. You know, I read the books of Lewis Mumford when I was, you know, in my teens and in high school. Well, of course, at that time, there wasn't any such courses. Right now, I'm grateful I didn't go into it looking what happens to city planners anyway.
What would you say were real highlights in your life? Things that you...
There are all kinds of positive and negative. Breaking my arm when I was 7 years old. Yeah, well, I mean, you know, to learn about mortality at that young an age is impressive. Going to music and art, that opened up a sort of different world.
Yeah.
Going to work camp in Finland, that was a highlight. Getting married, being accepted at Harvard, going to London School of Economics, being accepted there, going to England, and coming to Alaska. I mean, we didn't, you know, fly up. We drove up. We stopped off and visited people and, you know, friends. Black in the co-op movement and the farmers union and the pacifist groups, and so it took us about 3 months to get up here. I met all of these wonderful people on the way, and in both the United States and in Canada, and then meeting the Griffiths, staying up two nights and just talking, going to work. Then first few years of homesteading, where we both worked very hard physically and worked together before Joan got so wound up to taking care of children and horses, you know. But, I don't think I have ever, I can't really remember having been bored. So I suppose I was in college a few times. I remember sneaking off and watching Grade Z cowboy movies. Nothing else to do. But that was an undergraduate. But I guess my life is in more peaks and valleys than a smooth plane.
Do you think that the part of that is, it's obviously a lot of that is by your attitude. And do you think that most of us shape our lives just simply by our attitude, or is it, and that's not easy. I mean, I was thinking, so.
Well, it's also, you know, what we sort of dare to do or, mm-hmm. or want to do. I think a lot of people sort of compartmentalize their lives. You know, they have a job because it's a job and they get money from it, but they don't seem to find any particular joy in that. Mm-hmm. And I've always tried to do things that I'm interested in or get interested in what I'm doing, which means very often I haven't stuck at some things too long. But I enjoyed being a typewriter repairman, office machine mm-hmm. repairman, because mm-hmm. it was an intellectual puzzle. I stayed with it until I got tired, you know, and did something else. Probably that's one of the reasons I never became a construction electrician, besides the fact of perhaps having to go to jobs up north and leave my mm-hmm. family, because the sort of production line work is dulling. But then they have hobbies or something on the side. Well, I'm a model railroad buff, yet I've never really been able to find the time to immerse myself in that way that some of my fellow hobbyists did, because mm-hmm. what else I'm doing is so interesting too.
Mm-hmm.
If I could figure out a way to make a living model railroading, I'd probably try that for a few years. I don't know. But
it's a very common sort of jargon term used a lot nowadays, and I always hesitate to use it, but called a risk taker. And so I guess is really what you're talking about.
I'm a very conservative risk taker, but I do take risks. And maybe it's a bit more stubbornness. You know, I get to a certain point and I won't.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just going
to. There's certainly a certain openness to whatever happens. Mm-hmm. And a lack of fear. Wouldn't you say that there's a certain importance in not being afraid of life?
No.
Seeing life as a positive thing rather than.
But it isn't always up. I mean, I've been in despair and black gloom and all that. At least it gives you something to go up from.
I didn't mean quite in that way. I meant in it as generally. A lot of people are very fearful about their life. They feel that they sort of imagine the worst and assume what's going to happen. Okay. I noticed, interestingly enough, in a lot of people that certainly I've interviewed in this project, that they have sort of, certainly they've been frightened and nervous or aware, but they've gone past this and said, well, life is something to be lived anyway. I mean, if you're going to, you have said in a sense, compartmentalize your life, or then nothing can happen. But if you, so do you think fear was a lack of fear, and this has come out of faith?
I remember as a child, as I mentioned, you know, when I'm looking at the New York Yellow Press, especially the Journal American with their Sunday edition, they always had some great disaster that was going to happen, you know. The sun was going to heat up and burn up the world, or it was going to shrivel to a cinder and we were all going to freeze.
Mm-hmm.
Comets were going to hit the earth. And boy, as a kid, I was absolutely terrified of these things. I had nightmares about them. And the reason I mentioned the breaking my arm when I was whatever age it was, must be 1937, I'd be 9 years old actually, and I was at school, I was climbing up one of these cliffs in the West Bronx and I did something stupid and fell off and broke the arm very thoroughly, and it got infected and I got gangrene, and I only survived because they were experimenting with this new German drug, the dyes, you know, sulfa dyes. They were using it as a dye, colored dyes. They run it in a tube in the arm, and they irrigate the arm, and then they had a drain. I called it a faucet. It was a little glass faucet on the side. But anyway, apparently one they were going to cut the arm off, only the infection spread too far, and, you know, they sort of despaired, and they called my parents. But I remember that that time that everything had been hurting, and the ward was full of crying children, kids had fallen through skylights and burned themselves, all kind of mess. And it was just Morrisania, New York, Morrisania Hospital.
You weren't with your parents at that time?
Just a charity patient. What?
You weren't with your parents at that time?
Oh, yeah, I was. But I was in the hospital. I mean, they were home. Actually, it was worse than that. My father had his cataract that I'd been operated on. So, pretty bad situation. My mother was at home. My father was in another hospital. But I remember, you know, sort of everything was hurting and uncomfortable. And it stopped hurting. And I had a bowl of pea soup, most delicious pea soup in the world. And that night, everything sort of was calm and peaceful. And the bed and, you know, furniture and everything seemed to glow with a light of their own. And I was looking at myself. From the height of about, you know, these out-of-body experiences. And I went away and came back. And I began to recover. And somehow, you know, all the night terrors of childhood never came back again after that. So, I hate to say, at the age of 9, I had, you know, whatever kind of experience one wants to call it, and certainly, I think, had a lot to do with changing that, you know, beginning of some change of attitude. Mm-hmm. And that, maybe that's too dramatic. Maybe it was just, you know, growing up in the Depression where things got about as bad as they could, can't you figure, well, what the hell? Mm-hmm. And, you know, not only the Depression and living very close to the bone and going, when my mother had work with these, you know, at the thaws, you know, and seeing how the upper half lived, as it were. Then the sort of drumbeat of the coming of the Second World War. And I think people forget how much that impinged on consciousness. And children are very aware of that.
To
see, you know, on the Fox Movie Tone News right after Donald Duck cartoon, see the U.S. gunboat 10A sunk by Japanese bomber, to see the children in Shanghai having been bombed by Japanese bombers, to see Guernica. You know, we talked about the Vietnam War being the first TV war. Well, all of those little wars were, we saw them every Saturday in the Movie Tone News, along with, you know, Buck Rogers, Ken Maynard, and Hoot Gibson, and the latest cowboy pictures, Eyes and Ears of the World, you know, stuff. And Hitler making speeches, and Mussolini posturing, and and Tojo looking inscrutable.
Funny, but I remember everything being very black and white. That's a real difference I see now. Is that maybe our total thinking has changed a little bit.
The fact that I develop for one reason or another, a pacifist ethic, it doesn't make me think that, you know, fascism or Nazism or Stalinism were in any way justifiable in the regime. They were horrible, and I cannot see how the war could have been avoided. And there's a big difference between what nations and states have to do and what the moral choice that individuals make, and that's always very tricky as to who makes what kind of choice and what you do. I think that they could have been prevented by more decisive action, more sort of solidarity among people. But in the Depression, the world economy is all screwed up because of nationalism and tariffs and exploitation, you're not going to get that. Don't think about it afterwards.
What do you think provokes people to think? Anyway, I mean, there's a certain level of complacency where nothing happens, and you either have to be very poor or very hungry or very put upon to make change.
I think also, you know, living in what was primarily a Jewish neighborhood and hearing the arguments between the Zionists and the non-Zionist Jews, the labor Jews, and the Finland. In fact, I suppose that one of my reasons for never being 100% patriot was Finland's ambiguous position, being attacked by Russia, which we were opposed to, which then became our great ally and that kind of thing. So. And I went to a very intellectual high school, too. I mean, where kids were always discussing things. We had discussion groups that met after school to talk about things like that. We met in the Episcopal Orphan Asylum across the street. Earlier, you asked me what I should think, though I couldn't give you a name, that the librarians of the city had in these neighborhood libraries in New York were influenced me a lot, you know. They encouraged my reading. I just devoured everything. I remember one set of books by Alan Villiers. I think he was a Canadian or English author who wrote about life at sea, you know, the sailing ships.
And oh, I did that down for my son because he's
You know, the grain trade with Australia. And they were mostly Finnish ships from the Åland Islands. I mean, they were, you know, because the Finns were the last ones in the sailing trade. They would run grain from Australia to England.